This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Big year in North Carolina news. The man known to many as America's pastor, evangelist Billy Graham, passed away at the age of 99. Hurricane Florence tore through the state, causing billions of dollars in damage. Protesters toppled the Confederate Silent Sam statue on the campus of UNC Chapel Hill. And North Carolina had its own blue wave, with Democrats breaking the supermajority in the General Assembly. State of Things was there with you through it all, and over the next couple of weeks, we're going to reflect on the many moments that shaped this year. And to do that, we'll bring you conversations with the State of Things staff, who usually sit on the other side of the glass. Joining me in the studio today is Anita Rao. She's the managing editor of the show and a voice you may recognize for her time on the air as a guest host this summer. Anita, welcome back.
Thanks, Frank.
We're never in the studio at the same time together.
We never are.
On vacation. Big year for the show, right? What are some of the highlights for you?
Yeah, so we started the year with two new producers. So we had a whole new team and did a full year with them. We made two trips to Asheville, which are always great. We connect with our hosts and the reporters out there, cover a lot of good stories, monthly trips to Greensboro, and obviously all of the breaking news.
So what conversation stood out for you?
Yeah, so I want to talk first about a new partnership we formed with the Southern Oral History Program. So this is a collection of 6,000 interviews that's housed at UNC Chapel Hill. And we realized that there was this huge body of amazing oral history interviews that touched on so many topics that we talk about on our show and could provide really interesting context to some of our conversations. So we partnered up with the Southern Oral History Program to check in with them from time to time to talk about some of the projects that they're working on.
Let's listen to a clip now with Rachel Seidman. She's the director of the Southern Oral History Program, talking about her reaction to getting a call from a cardiologist who wanted to work with her. Cardiologist Dr. Ross Simpson, who's also featured in this segment, he wanted to use oral history techniques to better understand sudden death in adults.
I was really stunned when Dr. Simpson called me. I mean, the idea of a cardiologist calling a historian and asking for help was novel, shall we say. But I was really thrilled by the idea of a colleague at UNC who was curious in that kind of way outside a disciplinary box.
The Oral History Project has as an archive, obviously. So you've got all of these tape-recorded conversations. How did you think about how they could possibly inform this question, and how do you even go about searching?
Well, I knew that part of what Dr. Simpson was interested in were questions about, you know, where do people get information from, or who do they trust? How do they think about health and their lives in relationship to other people, or perhaps to religion, or, you know, other things? We identified several hundred interviews where somebody either talked about an experience with sudden death, or they talked about doctors, or they talked about health in some form or fashion that we thought might be worth pursuing.
So, Dr. Simpson, going into this, what do you think you're going to be listening for?
I actually had a hypothesis. That's what medical people do all the time, that we'd see weak social support, because that was one of the things that we thought was an overriding cause of sudden death. And we found actually really strong social support.
Yeah, we have an indication of that in one of the samples that we brought with us today. This is a clip from an interview recorded with Vicki Everhart in Stanley County, North Carolina. She and her husband adopted two children from Russia. One of them was in need of a lot of medical care. And in the interview, she describes what happened in the aftermath. Her son got the surgery. It was pretty risky all the way through, and he survived. And let's hear what happened next.
He had to learn everything all over again because he was so, so, so bad. He's a multimillion-dollar kid, literally. And had it not been for the community coming together to help raise funds, Pfeiffer College had, they had two different plays that they put on, and Richfield Elementary had a penny drive, and the fire department had a hamburger dinner, and then they did a cookout. He was the face of every little kid who everybody always thought wouldn't make it, and he's still here.
Now, it's a clip from an oral history interview with Vicki Everhart. It was recorded this summer in Stanley County as part of a new collaboration and a research initiative between the Southern Oral History Program and healthcare providers curious about using oral history to better understand health practices and behavior. So, Dr. Simpson, you went in thinking, well, probably inadequate, broken networks, social networks may be one of the things. We heard in that clip, certainly, there was a robust social network. Now, that's one story. What do you do from that to probe your hypothesis even further? What did you find out from there?
Well, we certainly haven't given up the hypothesis because there's a lot of reasons this might be a selective story. Right. However, it also did point to us that we needed to be a little more broad-based in our thinking. And that was one thing we got from the oral historians, that we have to, as physicians, as healthcare providers, we have to know the people. We have to understand what's going on. What are they feeling? What do they think? What are they concerned about? To understand their behaviors and then to understand how they work with the healthcare system.
That's a clip from a conversation earlier this year with cardiologist Dr. Ross Simpson and Southern Oral History Program Director Rachel Seidman. And I'm here with State of Things Managing Editor Anita Rao talking about her favorites from the year gone by. What'd you like about that conversation?
So I think in academic circles all the time we hear big words like synergy and cross-disciplinary collaboration. And this is an example of where that actually works really well. They were super grounded and did a great job bringing together people from various fields to really bring light to a topic in a different way.
Yeah, and it helps us a lot, too, because they have all that great tape and it's nice to be able to get it out there. Well, the next clip is from our recurring series Back Channel with popular culture contributors Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. Tell us about putting together Back Channel.
Back Channel is an incredibly difficult segment to put together, but so rewarding. We pull together pieces of audio from movies, TV shows, artists talking about their work, sometimes have between 15 and 18 clips that we're trying to squeeze into an hour, all while giving our guests a chance to elaborate and share their own personal thoughts. But it's really exposed me to a bunch of work that I was not familiar with before, and it's been really fun to put on, especially when we get to feature North Carolina artists like we did in the segment that I'm going to play here in a second.
Tell us about it.
Yeah. So in this clip, we have a conversation with Yaba Blay. She is a professor at North Carolina Central University who has her own web series called Professional Black Girl. So we had her on to talk a little bit about the project and how she got started.
Professional Black Girl is the project I never intended to do, but it is my most favorite thing of every single day. I was actually working on another video series in my mind, at least, one that was more focused on nuanced conversations about Black hair culture. And in my mind, I was just going to have like a quick ending segment called Professional Black Girl. I started using the hashtag because folks who follow me on social media know that I'm there to play. Right? For the most part. And Instagram is probably my favorite of them all. So sharing images, and folks would tag me in images and videos and send, because they know I love little girls, especially clowning and being grown, whatever that means. And so I started using that hashtag as a way to kind of characterize the level to which they were being Black girls. And so to me, that was a professional level. And so I didn't have a rationale at the time, and now the more I started using it, the more other people started using it, and once I started doing the video series, I came to realize just how important it was to nuance the language around professional, particularly for Black women and Black girls. I see it a lot now working at an HBCU where I know that a lot of my students are being encouraged by other Black women to act a particular way, to dress a particular way, to wear their hair in a particular way, to lose weight, to do all these things because there's this notion that out there in the quote-unquote real world, you have to not be yourself.
Are we in a particular moment where you feel comfortable doing that, where we can all feel comfortable, say, as you said, I'm a scholar and nobody wants to talk about that thing, but you as a scholar can appear in other on other platforms and say, let's have fun?
Absolutely. I think it's important. I think for myself or someone like Asia, Dr. Treva Lindsay was also in the episode, Raps. There were so many women who, again, you would call quote unquote professional from your standard definitions, but what you see them as being real regular, right? And in that way, I think a lot of younger women, college age women's little girl and other everyday women can relate. So there's not that distance, right? Whatever you think about us aspirationally, recognize that we are just like you. What I really appreciate about something as simple as laying your baby hair down with brown gel is armor in a world that has told you to look this way in order to be seen as professional. And it's like, no, I'm going to do all the things that are so quintessentially, recognizably Black, and you're just going to have to deal.
That's a clip from an episode of our recurring series Back Channel featuring North Carolina Central University professor Yaba Blade. I'm talking with managing editor Anita Rao about her favorites from 2018. Tell us more about Back Channel.
Yeah, so Back Channel is a recurring series every month with two popular culture experts. We talk about a huge range of topics and sometimes get to feature North Carolina artists. And this is my favorite because there's so much great cultural production going on in this state. And it's really nice to hear Natalie and Mark, who are big thinkers, who are really paying attention to things happening at the national level, really shine a spotlight on what's happening in our state and connect their personal experience to the work of artists who are making work all around us.
Yeah, that's managing editor Anita Rao. She's with me today sharing her favorite moments from 2018. And there's more to come on the state of things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow, talking today with State of Things managing editor Anita Rao, with me to talk about her favorite SOT conversations from 2018. So what's next?
So next up, I have a Monday meet, and this is a segment that I talk about every year. It is the beginning of our week where we sit down with one guest for the entire hour, and it's really a great time for us to slow everything down. We're usually jumping three or more topics every hour, but on Mondays we spend one full hour just with one guest, really unraveling their personal life and their professional story and how everything intersects. And this meet to me is a perfect example of the beauty of what a Monday meet can be. So this is Robin Tomlin. Earlier this year, she was appointed the first regional McClatchy editor for the Carolinas. She's also the executive editor of the News and Observer and the Herald Sun, and she'd actually just started on the job when we had her into the studio.
Well, let's listen to a clip from our conversation with Robin Tomlin. She's the editor of both the News and Observer and the Herald Sun. And we started by talking about her early years. Here she's describing what her career aspirations were when she was younger.
Unlike so many people I meet who had this very strong plan, I really didn't. At some points thought I might be a teacher. I loved, got involved in theater very young and loved being on stage and acting. And mostly because I loved being around the people who were creative and who were storytellers more than because I was actually very good at it. I don't think I ever was. So I really didn't have a clear direction and wasn't all that, great of a student, So I sort of fumbled my way, through those years. And it wasn't until later that I sort of found my drive and passion.
And in high school, you became pregnant.
I did. Yes. My senior year of high school, I had been dating a guy for several years who was off at college and discovered early in my senior year that I was pregnant and had to make a big decision.
Not helped necessarily by the fact that you had, was it a guidance counselor or a teacher who really wanted you to leave school, right?
Yeah, initially I had an English teacher who really tried to convince me that I didn't belong there. And they had a night school program in Durham, and she, really encouraged me to go there. She, said that she thought I would be uncomfortable, that it would be very difficult for me. But it became really clear in our conversations that it really wasn't about me, that she was very much feeling that I was a bad example to other people. And so I actually did go to the night school classes, tried them out a couple times and said, you know what, this isn't me. I'm going to go and I'm going to hold my head high. And I'm going to, when I was firm in the decision that I was going to, become a mom, I just went back and walked across that stage at the Dean Dome.
Well, there was even a question about that, right?
There was. Yeah. The guidance counselors tried to convince me not to do that. They thought that it might be a bad look. But thankfully, they supported me ultimately. I mean, I do think there are probably schools where that wouldn't have happened, where in the end they would have made a decision and it wouldn't have been mine. But ultimately, I was a little stubborn, a little like my grandmother in that too, and said, no, this is what I want to do. And ultimately, they let me do it.
So you walked across the stage, but where were you going after that?
I didn't know. I had no idea. Initially, I the one thing I was good at was taking care of children. I'd been a babysitter from, as long as you could babysit. And so I initially got a job as a nanny, working with a family, bringing my son with me to take care of the other two kids. I did that for a while and realized maybe I had an entrepreneurial bug, and I was like, you know, I could probably do this in my own home and take care of more children and actually make a little bit more money, enough money hopefully to be able to support my son. And so I did. I opened a home daycare and took care of my son plus four other children.
You're like 20 years old, right?
Yeah, well, yeah, 21. Like 19, 20. Yeah. And you know, from 7 o'clock in the morning until 6 or 7 at night, and then I was changing diapers, and they were all under the age of 2. So if you can imagine, it was really an experience. I sometimes look back and I'm going, how did I do that? I'm not entirely sure I know, but you know, you learn how to kind of manage the chaos, and that's definitely been a theme of my life kind of ever since.
And is it true that the newspaper was your escape?
It was. So the kids would go down for a nap, and you know, I had a relatively small little townhouse, and so they were in porta cribs kind of all you know, along the walls, and I needed to be quiet. You know, I needed to keep them asleep so they could get their rest and I could get a break. And so the newspaper was the thing that I turned to, and it was really you know, kind of a remarkable thing. I had not, you know, I had read the News and Observer growing up. My parents had had it in the house, but you know, like a lot of kids, I really didn't get it. And then suddenly, in this moment, it was a way for me to connect to the world outside of that room where I was sitting, and I, you know, got to read about things that were happening all over the world, and read comics and did puzzles, and you know, really had an opportunity to just kind of take a deep breath, and I fell in love with journalism. I, you know, I saw this. You know, suddenly this my attachment to this, you know, piece of paper, this collection of paper, that helped me feel like I was connected to the larger world, to my community, first of all, and then really to the larger world.
So you actually started to think about the craft. I mean, who's writing these stories?
And
what that was your fantasy. And
I did. Yeah. I mean, I started to feel like I had a relationship with the columnists, you know, who were writing. And I still didn't know at that point I wanted to be a journalist, but I knew that I really wanted to be a newspaper reader, you know, somebody who valued the kind of stories that were being told. So that became important to me.
That's a clip from my conversation with Robin Tomlin, regional McClatchy editor for the Carolinas and executive editor of both the News and Observer and the Herald Sun. And I'm here with State of Things managing editor Anita Rao, who is sharing her favorite segments from 2018. So what did you like about that one?
I, as a managing editor, I don't get to produce as much as I used to. So to sit down with someone and talk for 2 to 3 hours and hear their life story is always a treat for me. This kind of interviewing is really what brought me to radio in the first place. And Robin has managed at various levels of a newsroom throughout her career. And as a woman in a managing role in a newsroom, there aren't a ton of other examples of women who have taken non-traditional paths to do this or who've, you know, conquered various obstacles along the way. So I really loved hearing someone reflect so honestly how she approached each of those decisions along her career path, and learned a lot myself from her story.
Well, you learned a lot and then got to apply it. You have been on this side of the glass, and that was when you were filling in for me when I was on vacation.
That's right. You left us for 5 weeks this
month.
Summer.
Let me just say this. I've never taken a month vacation before. I've been out of work a long time, many, many months, but not a voluntary vacation. And I will tell you, the only reason I did it is because I heard you on your podcast, She and Her, and I know you can do this job very well, and you did.
I did, and I had a blast. It was very nerve-wracking, but it was really incredible. I've reflected a lot on what I learned this summer, and I think the biggest thing for me was I loved how my brain worked when I was hosting. It was a very meditative experience. You can really only focus on one thing at a time. What's happening in front of you? What that guest is saying? Oh, the line dropped. Now I need to remember the 10 things I read this morning to stay on the air. And this actually did happen to me multiple times. So it was a great act in sort of being where my feet are, which as a managing editor, I'm not always doing that. I'm tackling 10 different things at one time. So it was really nice. It was a great experience.
And you got to your opportunity to record your own Monday Meet this summer. Talk about that.
Yeah. So I got to talk with Asha Bala. She is a dance instructor at the Leela School of Dance in Cary. And she is a teacher of Bharatanatyam, which is a type of Indian classical dance that I actually grew up doing. And so it was so fun to learn much more about the history of this dance form and hear from a practitioner in North Carolina who's really trying to get young people engaged in bringing this ancient cultural tradition to light in the modern era.
All right, well, let's listen to a clip from that interview. State of Things managing editor Anita Rao interviewing Indian dance teacher Asha Bala earlier this year.
So tell me about how did young Asha come to know Bharatanatyam?
I grew up in an India that had recently gained independence and in a household where my parents had been actively involved in the freedom struggle. And it was as part of nation building, a lot of effort was put into reviving the local arts and crafts. And it was in that environment that Bharatanatyam was revived as one of the national treasures of India, a treasure that everyone wanted to acquire for their children who were born in post-independent India. And my parents were no different. And I was bundled into my perambulator at the age of 3 and sent to my first lessons in Bharatanatyam.
And you went in kicking and screaming, is that right?
Right, right. You know, and that period was, it was a roller coaster. So at that age, when you're 3 or 4 or 5, all that you want to do is play outside with your friends, and dance stopped me from doing that. So it was always a tug of war, a battle of wills.
How did you fall in love with Bharatanatyam from there?
So there was this eureka moment when I was some 12 or 13. My father, who was a banker, casually asked me if I would perform in one of his office events. And given how shy I was at that time, I have no idea what came into me, but I said, sure, I will. And I remember dressed up and waiting in the wings to enter the stage for my first solo performance. There was just a moment of tremor in my legs, just for a fraction of a second. But once I entered the stage and started doing my thing, I was completely comfortable dancing in front of so many pairs of eyes. I had no stage fright. So just like that, from that of being a timid, unwilling kid standing in the last row of her dance class, I became this eager young dancer. Eager young dance student, not a dancer yet. But, you know, when you show promise, there is also expectation. So that pull between what I was willing, the effort I was willing to put in as a teenager and my teacher's expectations continued. And these teachers were brilliant masters of their craft. They were custodians of this art in the truest sense of the term, teaching us not only dance, but a whole way of life where respect for all things art was deeply ingrained in us.
So you went on to found Leela School of Dance in Kerry, which we've spoken about, and you're teaching to students living in the Indian diaspora. And I mean, speaking as a student of Indian dance and someone who grew up in the United States with parents that it was really important to them to instill a sense of connection to Indian culture and heritage, but that's so hard when all of the forces around you are pulling you in other directions. How do you engage your students in understanding this deep history and try to pull them into something that feels so unfamiliar?
So we have developed a curriculum for Leela School of Dance where the students get a good foundation in the technique of dance, and alongside the technique of this dance they are given assignments where they are asked to research and understand the historical structure, the philosophical structure of the stories, so that they get a complete understanding of the pieces that they are learning and learn to value what this dance has to offer.
So much of the dance is about storytelling. How do you take those themes that are in these ancient stories and make them relevant to a 14-year-old living in Cary, North Carolina?
So we try to make them, give them exercises which are more relatable to them. Think of an episode which makes you angry. You know, it could be something your brother has done that could make you angry. And something that is painful, maybe, you know, your stomach is paining because you've eaten too much ice cream, you know, something like that. So, and to be able to bring out these emotions. But also the stories, we make it more relevant to them. We show that connection that these stories have. Like we take the story of the Dashavataram, you know, and which talks about the 10 incarnations of Lord Vishnu. And it's such a neat story, which is relevant even today. It talks about evolution, but one of its incarnations is about preserving this planet Earth, how this planet Earth is being plundered by this demon. And so we ask them these questions, you know, who is this demon in this current context? Aren't we all the demons by wasting water, by filling the landfill and, cutting down trees? So aren't we these demons? So, you know, in that way, we are able to connect these ancient stories to these children of this generation.
We don't have much time left, but you were earlier this year, you did win a North Carolina Heritage Award, which distinguishes you as an artist contributing significantly to the cultural production of art in North Carolina. What does that distinction mean for you, and how do you see your art form as part of the landscape of North Carolina art?
So it was a tremendous honor for me personally, for someone who has come from another country, set up shop here, and overcome the challenges of teaching a culturally specific dance form, and to be recognized with this great award is a tremendous honor. But I think the greater honor is to the dance tradition, recognizing the dance tradition of India. It is a tradition that is still finding its feet on the cultural stage of this great country. And an award of this stature, of this magnitude, takes it one step closer to becoming a part of this cultural conversation. And that, to me, is the bigger honor.
That's a clip from our conversation between State of Things managing editor and fill-in host Anita Rao and Indian dance teacher Asha Bala. And I'm here with Anita, who, as I say, filled in on the State of Things this summer, talking about her favorite conversations from 2018.
So as I said, I grew up dancing Bharatanatyam, this Indian classical dance form, and learned a lot through this interview. But one thing I really found myself thinking about was how much of my own story and perspective to insert within the conversation. Because there were times when I knew I needed to kind of serve as an ally to the listener to help them understand what Asha was saying. But there were times when I wondered, is it necessary for me to bring in my own story? And I wonder for you, how do you make that choice in the moment? How often is that happening in your head?
It's happening a lot, and it depends on the relationship. It really does. If I know I've got a close relationship and I'm deeply connected, even if I've only just met them, to the listener, I feel comfortable telling part of my story because I believe the listener can hear the relationship. And so it's fair for me to do this, and it's not coming out of the blue. If I feel like we haven't established it personally with the guest and then with the larger body of the audience, I don't, because it's like out of the blue. It's like, well, why are you talking about you, Frank? So I really measure it by the closeness of our relationship and how I feel that that's going out.
I noticed that a lot this summer because people would come back to me and say, oh, I wish I'd heard more of you in that segment, or I learned so much about you in that segment. So I think based on how much they know about me and know about my relationship to the guest, everyone hears that differently. But that was a part of hosting that I didn't really think too much about until I was in the moment on air navigating that.
Yeah. And when I heard you, so when I came back and you said, when I asked you how it went and you said, you know, it's meditative. And I thought, that's just the answer I want to hear, because you'll talk to so many people who had a feeling, it was terrifying. I was so scared. I was thinking about the clock and I thought about the thing. And then the line went down. And when you didn't say terrifying, but meditative, I knew that you got it as a host, because that's the only place you can be is on top of the next word you're going to say, and trust that you've got a brain full of stuff that's going to, you know, probably empty into some goodness. So that's how I knew we had made the right choice. And I'm going again in July, so I hope you're ready.
All right.
Now, here's another thing, a tricky thing about hosting. I remember when I first sat in as a guest host, when I first started doing this, terrifying thing for me was I was sitting in for people who were extremely well-known to their audience, and I thought, how do I, first of all, honor the show that they heard, because they want to hear that guest or that host, but not be them, because I can only be good if I'm coming for me. Did you face that challenge?
I did. And I think it was about a week and a half in that I had a bit of a breaking point where I realized that I'm not you and I can't be you. And this is not Frank 2.0. So how can I lean into my strengths and the things that are interesting to me and really bring that on the air? So we had a lot of fun, actually, the producers and I, kind of sitting down and talking about how we could make the topics of the show reflect things that maybe you weren't exactly as interested in, but I was, and we would have a different sound for this month while still maintaining the integrity of the show, and that was really okay. So there are a couple of segments that we're going to talk about later, but we kind of looked at trends among millennials and talked about, you know, various aspects of younger culture. And I think at the beginning, I was hesitant to lean into that. And then I kind of realized, like, this is who I am. I need to own this experience. I will sound more confident on the air and the topics will be more interesting. If I'm genuinely interested in them, the conversations will be more interesting and the guests and the listeners will all hear that.
Good choice. I think it worked. Anita Rao, managing editor of The State of Things. She's going to stay with me just ahead as we talk more about her favorites from 2018. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow, and with 2019 just around the corner, we're taking a step back to talk about some of our favorite State of Things conversations this year. I'm here with managing editor Anita Rao, who filled in as a guest host for the show this summer, and you have another conversation from your time hosting that you'd like to share. What's next?
Yeah, so as I spoke about in the last segment, I tried to lean into things that I was hearing among my friends and community that I thought would be of interest for the show. And so the conversation that I'm about to play is about fat activism. And the idea for this conversation stemmed from the series of articles I was reading about how everyone really knows what the body positivity movement is, and that's really taken hold in a lot of spheres. But alongside it, there's another movement that's trying to tackle this cultural obsession with obesity and point out the political and health consequences of assuming that larger bodied people inherently should try or should want to be losing weight or should eat less and move more. So really thinking about fat discrimination as something separate from body positivity. So I presented to the team. We spent some time talking through the best way to approach it, and we landed on the conversation that you're going to hear.
All right. Well, let's listen to a clip of that conversation now. State of Things managing editor Anita Rao talking with Reagan Chastain, fat activist and blogger, also joined by Penny Gordon-Larson, a professor and associate dean for research in nutrition at the UNC Gillings School of Global Public Health.
So I know the term body positivity has become more popular in American lexicon. That's a little bit different from what you call fat activism. Tell me, what exactly is fat activism?
So fat activism is the idea that fat people have the right to exist in fat bodies. And it doesn't matter why we're fat or what the quote-unquote consequences of being fat might be. We have the right to exist without shame, stigma, bullying, or oppression.
And you claim the term fat actively. Tell me about why you choose to claim that term.
I do. So first of all, it's a perfectly good adjective that other people have been allowed to sort of heap negative connotations on. And so I want my adjective back. And it doesn't pathologize my body the way that other terms do. So like overweight, for example, like I'm short, I'm not medically under tall. And so by the same logic, I'm fat, I'm not over some, you know, non-existent weight that I'm not. And it's kind of just a way that I let my bullies know that they can't have my lunch money anymore. So it's a reclaiming term for me as well.
And how did this reclamation, how did you come to this point in your journey? What is the history of your relationship with your body that's led to this work as a fat activist?
Well, I was always bigger, but I was also a successful athlete growing up. And so I didn't have a lot of body shaming. And then like my junior year of high school, my friend's mom told me, you know, you're going to lose that weight before college, right? Like you don't want to go to college fat, do you? And that started sort of my first serious diet that spiraled all the way into an eating disorder. And so in recovering from the eating disorder, I was still considered like too heavy. And so I was being treated for eating disorder, but simultaneously doctors were telling me to lose weight and prescribing all these different diets. And I was having the same response that I later learned almost everyone does, which is I would lose weight short term and then I'd gain it back long term no matter what I did, often gaining back more than I had lost. And so finally, I was doing this incredibly strict medically supervised program, but I was still gaining weight. And so I told them I wanted to quit. And they said, oh, well, you know, you can't quit. And I was like, no, I'm pretty sure I can. And so they put me in this little room with a woman who was flipping through this binder of pictures of fat women. And she said, maybe you don't know it, but this is what you look like. And these women are going to die alone on the couch eating bonbons. And is that what you want for your life? And aren't you tired of hating your body? And so that was like a really pivotal moment because first of all, I was like, that's what I look like. Like, I thought I looked so much, you know, quote unquote, worse than those women. And so it was the first inkling that I had that I didn't hate their bodies. So why did I hate mine so much? And I grew up in rural America on cattle ranches, so I didn't know what a bonbon was. That went over my head completely. But I was like, God, yeah, I am tired of hating my body. Like, I'm exhausted from hating. I had been hating my body like it was a job, like I was getting paid to do it. And it hadn't made me any healthier or thinner or happier. It just made me miserable. And so at that point, I decided I was going to separate the two and I was going to learn to love my body. And then I was going to, you know, figure out how to get healthy. And so that was when I started sort of down the path of figuring out, like, my body does all of these amazing things for me. And I hadn't had a second's worth of gratitude for any of that because I was too busy complaining that it didn't fit to some stereotype of beauty that I had been sort of force-fed practically since birth in this culture.
I want to bring in another guest to the conversation now, Penny Gordon Larson. She is a professor and associate chair for research in nutrition at the UNC Gillings School of Global Public Health. She's also an obesity expert. Penny, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks, Anita.
Yeah, so tell me a little bit about sort of what Reagan was alluding to, that fat discrimination and fat stigma is a really prevalent problem. Do you consider fat stigma a public health issue?
Absolutely. And I think one of the biggest issues we face is in healthcare, with a majority of healthcare providers not trained adequately to deal with obese patients and obese people. And that results a lot of times in that same kind of bias or discrimination that Reagan just told a story about, because size and health habits don't necessarily go hand in hand. You can have a healthy lifestyle at any size.
So maybe you can't look at someone and know what their health is, but think about a common scenario. You walk into the doctor's office, you get on a scale, the scale reads a certain number, and then the doctor says, okay, you are overweight, you are obese, and this is what I encourage you to do. What do you see as the problem with that scenario?
So the problem with that scenario is usually the message that they're going to give to the individual is eat less, move more. And for most people, it's a lot more complicated. And, you know, there's a lot of information that needs to be gleaned about health habits overall. So not just diet and exercise, but also sleep and stress and other factors that play a role. Also, the medications that people are taking, which there's an estimate that about 10% of obesity is associated with taking, you know, various medications that have that side effect.
So, Reagan, tell me about your experience going in to the doctor and getting this kind of messaging that you need to eat less and move more. You say that focusing on weight loss is a problem.
Oh, it's a huge problem. So my focus of study in school was research methods and statistical analysis. And so when I decided I wanted to figure out how to get healthy, I also decided I was going to find the best diet, the one that worked the most. And so I did a literature review of all of the literature I could find about weight loss. And what I found was that there's not a single study of any method where more than a tiny fraction of people succeed long term. So even if we believe that body size is a problem, to prescribe weight loss is statistically the worst advice we could give people based on everything that we know.
Penny, what's your take on the diet studies that are out there?
So before I get to the diet studies, one thing that's important to consider is the fact that even 5% of weight loss in an obese person can bring about clinically meaningful change. And that's really what's important to think about, is what is the clinically meaningful impact of the weight loss as opposed to cosmetic. But the data on weight loss and diets is very complicated. When you look at these studies that are published, they're publishing the average effect. So there's a lot of variation in who's susceptible to what kinds of changes. And what we are ideally trying to do is tailor the kind of program that works the best for the person.
So, Reagan, some may hear what you're saying, that, you know, focusing on weight loss is not where we should focus, as you promoting the idea that being obese is healthy. Can you talk about your response to that? I know that's a common criticism of the fat activism movement.
Sure. First of all, being fat is fine. There's nothing wrong with being fat regardless. You're allowed to live a full and amazing and happy life regardless of your body size, your health, your ability. But this idea that if we have fat people out there succeeding at something other than weight loss or being happy in their bodies without trying to manipulate their size, that that's somehow promoting obesity, is actually ridiculous. People are the size that they are. And the idea that we say, you know, determine how you want to prioritize your health and how you want to get there, and it's okay if you do that at the body size that you are now, and it's okay if you love that body. Loving your body, never being an obligation, but always being an option, is so incredibly important.
Well, that was a clip from State of Things conversation recorded earlier this year between guest host Anita Rao and fat activist blogger Reagan Chastain and public health scholar Penny Gordon-Larson. Anita is also the managing editor of the State of Things with me now to talk about her favorites. What about that conversation stood out for you?
That to me was an example of the many hats the host has to wear, and it was a bit unexpected, honestly. I thought the two guests were going to have more in common than they ended up having, and I really had to kind of quickly pivot into the role of a moderator, which we're always kind of working that careful balance in our show where we want to have people of opposing opinions, but we don't want it to sound like a debate. But we want it to be a healthy and robust conversation. I also had the challenge of one guest being in front of me in studio and one guest being remote on the phone. So this is one that I really go back and think about often of where could I have inserted myself more? Where did I need to play devil's advocate? And that really careful balance of wanting to make sure both people are heard and have their perspectives voiced, but also not letting it turn into a debate of the studies or something that listeners are just going to tune out and say, okay, these two people don't agree. I'm not interested anymore. And we got more emails about this one than I think any other I hosted this summer. So really clearly hit a chord with a lot of people.
Oh, yeah. I mean, and people are tuning into The Conversation. So in a lot of ways, just being mindful of that and keeping that responsibility sort of uppermost on your mind can be more powerful than actually making the right choice, because there are 1,000 right choices. That's the other thing you learn when you get to be an old guy. When you're no longer a millennial, you'll see what I mean. You have one more clip to share with us this hour. Can you set it up for us?
Yeah. So this was purely deeply diving into millennial life and culture. So we talked about rosé. I don't know if you've had rosé, Frank, but it is the pink drink, the pink wine.
It's sweet.
It is a bit sweet, but what we learn is it has a really long and interesting history and reputation. What I was curious about is how do you take something that's been around for a really long time and rebrand it in a way that suddenly everyone, something that's old is new again and everyone is into it. There are whole movements around it. There's frosé, which is frozen rosé. There's brosé, which is rosé for men. So we really wanted to investigate this phenomenon. And we had a really fun time because we had both a wine expert who could give us the history of the wine, how it was made, how that played a part, as well as a marketing expert who could really take us behind the scenes and understand the science of how you make something old new again.
That's master sommelier Laura Manick and marketing expert Martin Buchanan. And this clip starts after you ask Laura to describe how rosé is made. Let's listen.
Rosé is made in essentially three different ways. And the easiest way would just be to take a teeny bit of red wine and blend it with a large amount of white wine. The second method is, it was a byproduct for a while where you would concentrate your red wine. And so in order to concentrate the red color and or flavor, you would just bleed a little bit of the free run juice from the bottom of the tank. And that was used as a byproduct of basically this style is called saigner, to bleed in French. And then the third way is just a maceration. So instead of macerating your red grapes with your white juice for long periods of time, rather, you would do it for short periods of time and make that onion skin color or that magenta, slightly rosé pink color.
So if rosé has been around since 600 BC, as you suggest, how did it end up getting a bad reputation?
I think it was really maybe the popularity of brands like Lancer becoming, you know, this off-dry and or very sweet style of wine that was pink. And that really maybe made it popular at one point in the 70s, but then as people started developing a palate for drier styles of wine, then it was looked down upon as an inferior, unsophisticated wine from, you know, our grandparents. And just the association was always sweet and rosé.
So yeah, popular while we were into the sugar rush, then the reputation changed. When did you start to see the resurgence of interest after rosé had a bad reputation for almost two decades?
I would say from the mid-2000s through today, we really started to see increasing popularity in sophisticated drinkers, novices, enthusiasts. You know, it's an in-between wine, and it first started to see real popularity in places like the Hamptons and this, you know, the Mediterranean and Provence and like right around Marseille, where it was associated with a lifestyle of summer boating and yachting, actually, I should say.
Joining the conversation now is branding expert Martin Buchanan. He is a creative director at Trone Brand Energy, a branding and digital agency in High Point and Durham. Welcome to the show, Martin.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
What do you think happened?
Well, it, for all indications, it looks like the improvements Laura mentioned about the wine itself kind of meshed perfectly with the lifestyles of millennials who always like to embrace things that are somehow retro. They call it early onset nostalgia. They like to reach back in time and find something of their own. And they behave in a way that kind of defies what marketing has been all along. They take to social media and they promote themselves. And in doing so, they love to share their wine moments. They're also not particular about social mores that came before. You know, the rules of wine drinking fall on their deaf ears. And so they find this rosé. Nobody's drinking it. Let me try that. Oh, it's pink. Oh, look, it makes a great photograph. I'll post it on Instagram and pop. There goes the color making their feed look great. And then somebody else says, hey, I'll do that too.
Well, Laura, it seems like there was a confluence of factors happening at one time. There were producers sort of making these whirlwind promotional tours, magazine articles declaring it a thing. Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie came up with their own kind of rosé. But it also had to do with the fact that the production of it became better and it was cheaper than some other red and white wines. Can you tell me about those two factors?
Yes, absolutely. And I do agree that as a rise of quality, as a rosé became less of a byproduct and more of an intentional wine, it became very popular.
State of Things Managing Editor Anita Rao talking with Master Sommelier Laura Manick and marketing expert Martin Buchanan about rosé, conversation that aired earlier this year. Anita is with me. Any other favorites or any other reflections as we wrap up the show?
I think hosting really made me fall more in love with the exact thing that our show does, which is incredibly quirky. It's almost hard to define. It's that you can talk about rosé one day, you can talk about the NRA the next day, you can talk about state politics and international politics. And it's all kind of rolled into each other. And live talk radio is not a thing that is around as much anymore. So I love being able to be a part of kind of the most vibrant form of what this can be. And hosting was a really good insight into the power and beauty of that for me.
Well, for my part, I think you did beautifully. I think you're a fantastic managing editor. And now I'm so happy somebody knows what it's like to do this job from this side of the glass, particularly somebody who has your job. Anita Rao, managing editor of The State of Things, also filled in this summer. Thank you so much for a great year, Anita.
Thanks, Frank.
You can find links to all of her favorite segments at our website, stateofthings.org, a program produced by, is that Anita Rao? Is that how you say that? Laura Pelliser, Dana Terry, and Amanda Magnus. Robin Copley is our technical director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.